The wealth affects the housing. Morning, Mr. Dorfman.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Glenn Dorfman, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. It's an association of independent contractors, 25,000 folks. And the other day, because I don't want to spend much time on this, but the other day, the Department of Economic Development listed on their website the average weekly salary for a realtor in Minnesota is $662 a week. So I would argue that I probably represent the largest anti-poverty program in the private sector. And I say that with great respect for what they do. But it's certainly not what some people think it is. What I would like to do today is spend 15 minutes going through some slides that we put together based on a study that was done by the Joint Center for Housing at Harvard and the National Association of Realtors. And I weaved it in with Minnesota data, and then at the end, as a reward for being so kind to me and allowing me to do this, I brought a copy of the poll, a statewide poll that we did last week of 1,000 voters, 500 in greater Minnesota and 500 in the metro, because we'd like to think that we could be of some assistance to you guys in trying to resolve this budget problem. The reason for this presentation, however, is that very few people understand the both tax benefits that housing gets, federal and state, and nor do they understand what the Wall Street Journal reported about 3 months ago, which is that all of the losses in the stock market that occurred in 1999 because of the high-tech and communications bubble bursting was recouped by the end of 2004 in home equity. And so what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about that. Over the last 50 years, you have in your packets, I hope, this field, but it's on the slides above. Over the past 50 years, housing expenditures have accounted for about a fifth of the gross domestic product of the United States. Housing's influence on the economy, however, extends well beyond its direct effects. Housing also influences the level of consumer spending. As housing values increase, meaning as housing net wealth increases, consumers spend more. Now, there are a lot of people who are running around saying things like people are spending their seed corn. That's not true. That the data suggests, and I'll show you this on a slide in a minute, but the data suggests that for every dollar of market value increase in a home, the consumer spends about 5.5 cents of it. And by the way, that's about the same as it is on stock equity. As stock equity rises, people spend about 5.5 cents of it. The rest of it they reinvest or save. So they have spent even more freely since 1997 when the capital gains exclusion for the sale of principal residence was given to us by the Congress and President Clinton. There's an interesting story about that. President Clinton was approached by a bunch of, on a bipartisan basis, a bunch of Republicans and Democrats who were house rich. And not very wealthy, apparently. And so at the end of a session, they came up with this idea of excluding from taxation $250,000 of home equity at cash out, or $250,000 if you're single and $500,000 if you're married at the time you sell, as long as you lived in the home for two of the last 5 years. And some of you will remember that some years ago, right before the 99 crash, Minnesota had an enormous amount of capital gains coming in from the stock market. And on the one hand, I'm thrilled about having this provision. On the other hand, it didn't help the state. It helped the citizens, but it hurt us in terms of our capital gains collections, because basically we've basically said that we're going to treat an asset class differently than we treat other asset classes. So just to be clear, if a person lives in a house for two of the last 5 years and they sell it, that's one of the reasons you're seeing this huge increase in Minneapolis, St. Paul values. People are buying, living, and moving within the city, fixing these properties up, and they're making 30, 40, 50, 60, 80 grand at a clip. And it's not taxable. And we're going to see more of that, not less of it, among young people. So, in any case, capital gains coupled with home equity borrowing has escalated with rising home values. By the way, I view rising home values as a fabulous thing. Unlike some of you, I think that when people have more money, that's better for them because they can do the things they need to do with their families and pay their bills. Years ago, when I first started, 23 years ago, we used to talk about the people being taxed out of their homes. That's no longer possible because the market has responded with instruments like reverse equity mortgages, which permit senior citizens, healthy low-income senior citizens, to stay in their homes and as a supplement to Social Security or their modest pensions. Now, again, I want to stress that seniors, which is why we've testified over the years against subsidizing all seniors, while it's we know that it's politically attractive and we are sensitive to that, the idea of giving senior citizens, regardless of their income, some sort of benefit seems a little foolish because we're stealing the money from the kids. And we're starting to see that now in K-12 education, and I'll show you that in the poll in a minute. Of course, seniors overall have done the best economically of all demographic groups in our society since the advent of Medicare. And that data is available on the census. You can type in, or Mr. Gillespie, the state demographer site, you can type in and see how well Minnesota seniors are doing as an asset, as a demographic group. So Minnesota's house price appreciation over the last 7 years has been the sixth strongest in the U.S. The Minnesota Realtors believes that the $5 billion in rebates and tax cuts, which were both income and property, if you remember under Governor Carlson, the legislature and the governor decided to give back two sales tax rebates, and then under Governor Ventura, two property tax rebates, and then the income tax cuts that the committee discussed yesterday, putting back in, and together with the property tax reform reductions, that added up to $5 billion. Now, we don't talk about that very much here, but I'd like to stress it. When you take $5 billion and you stick it into an economy as modest as Minnesota's, that has an enormous stimulative effect. And we believe that that effect has been one of the factors, not as important as interest rates, but one of the key factors in bolstering Minnesota's housing values and their home ownership rate. We have the highest home ownership rate in the country right now at 80%. And for years, you know, I've been arguing with folks about is it because of the Minnesota property tax system that we have high home ownership? The reason that home ownership is high in places, West Virginia has a very high home ownership rate, very poor state, is that it all goes back to whether or not the state started out with a lot of homes versus rental. So the state of New York will never have a high home ownership rate. The state of California will never have a high home ownership rate. The state of Illinois will never have a high home ownership rate. And the reason is they have a lot of rental units. Large cities have lots of rental units. So it isn't taxes. It's never been taxes. But it makes for a good political bite. And that's important to stress because everybody keeps telling me how property taxes are rising out of hand and home values continue to rise. And they've been rising for the last 5 years, 8 years. Now you'll see shortly that they'll start to moderate, and I've talked to some of the assessors about this. We're going to start seeing home values move back down to the historical levels of 3 or 4% increases, and from 7, 8, 9%, that's some people will see that as a cut. But at the same time, commercial values are starting to rise again. So, for example, in the city of Minneapolis, we'll start seeing commercial bear a greater burden because they pay 2.5 or more times what residential pays. We'll start seeing the commercial property bear a larger burden as the values on residential decline and the values on commercial start to rise. That'll be true everywhere, by the way. Because of the legislative supported rebates, the four that I mentioned, and the 2001 reforms, we think that that had a monstrous stimulative effect. And I'm not a big supply sider, but whenever you dump $5 billion into a $30 billion economy, that's pretty, you know, it's much bigger than $30 billion in terms of what you guys spend. But the economy of Minnesota was, the people of Minnesota were enormously helped by what you do. According to model estimates from the mid to late 90s through 2004, strong house price appreciation in Minnesota and the U.S. overall, record home sales and unprecedented levels of borrowing against home equity accounted for at least 25% of the growth in personal consumption. Now, some of us don't like that much personal consumption, but the fact is that Mr. Greenspan said in 2001 and 2003 that he credited housing wealth, realized capital gains, and home equity borrowing with shoring up the economy in the aftermath of the stock market collapse in 2000. The most interesting thing that we saw, those of us who love you guys in this place, politics and the economy, is At a time when the economy in Minnesota was soft, home values continued to rise. And usually, home values are directly related to the wealth of the citizens as they're working in their jobs. So, in essence, even though lots of Minnesotans lost their jobs, they obviously got themselves retrained and found other work and are still doing that because the numbers are looking much more promising based on Mr. Stinson's numbers in the most recent budget update. Thank you.
Excuse us one moment. Representative Vila Forrest has an announcement here.
It's not that big. Everybody's waiting for the bomb to drop here.
I think he's going to announce he's going to run for Congress today.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, representing a portion of the 6th Congressional District, it's probably a big announcement that I'm one who is not considering running for Congress. In any case, members that like we have here with us today, students from Meadow Creek School in the fair city of Andover, and I merely wanted to welcome them to the Taxes Committee and to the Capitol. That is all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members.
Back to the presentation, Mr. Dorfman. Thank you.
Most typically, housing leads the economy into recessions. Interest rate hikes take the steam out of housing. We're a little concerned about that because based on Mr. Greenspan's most recent comments, he is not going to be as measured if inflation continues to look as bad as it does as a result of oil. One of the things that I was thinking last night to mention today is that not only is our consumers, Minnesota consumers, but national consumers in debt, not badly, but they're in debt, but oil prices are having an effect on them as well, not just on their cars, but it takes about 12, there's a 12-month lag between oil prices rising and consumable products increasing. So what we don't want to do, and the reason we've taken the position we've taken on the budget this year, what we don't want to do is we don't want to put the consumer of Minnesota goods and services at risk. To the degree that we could somehow manage not to put them at risk, that would be very helpful, and I'll be more specific in a minute. The accelerated pace of home sales and cash-out refinancing created the ballast that lifted consumer spending. Without housing's lift, consumer spending would likely have been half as great. Given that consumer spending makes up about two-thirds of all economic activity in the state, the recession would have been worse and the recovery less robust in the absence of the stimulus. Improving matters for Minnesotans was the fact, and I said that already, so I'm not going to repeat it, all the factors bolstered Minnesota's housing market and the net worth of Minnesotans to record levels. I think that's important. We rarely talk about this. We talk about mostly the people who were left behind, which is important if we were to target our resources to them. I said not long ago to Mr. McElroy that if we really wanted to, Minnesota is probably one of the few states in the country that could abolish poverty. We are the 49th lowest poverty state in the country based on the census, and we're the 7th highest per capita income in the country based on the census. So if we wanted to address in the way that Daniel Patrick Moynihan suggested 30 years ago, if we wanted to negative income tax or even help the poor by working poor by giving them vouchers, we could basically have Minnesota not have any people who are classified federally in poverty. I'm afraid that we're going to spend our time arguing about LGA and teacher salaries rather than that. But if we were able to get to that, it would be sort of lovely to actually be at the only state in the country that didn't have anybody at the poverty level. And I don't think very many states are in a position like we are. Further, home prices received a boost in the stock market. And here's why. During the time that the stock market was going up, people took a lot of the cash out, and they put a lot of money then in housing, which drove the price of it up. And as many of you know, even in greater Minnesota and small towns, there are a lot of big houses. And the reason is housing was a safer place for them to be after the 99 crash because it was something that was tangible, they could live in, they could enjoy, and when they cashed out of it, they could keep up to $500,000 married or $250,000 single. So on the falling stock values, a lot of investors, and we saw this both in the Wall Street Journal and it's fairly well documented in the financial journals, that a lot of people who were investing regularly in 401 in mutual funds and stocks took that money after they were hurt, that they were putting in regularly and put it into real estate, which again bolstered the value of the properties. Housing wealth effects are more immediate than stock wealth effects. This is a very interesting finding of the study. I mentioned a minute ago that about 5.5 cents out of every dollar increase in housing wealth is used by the consumer, and it only takes about a year for the spending from housing wealth to reach 4/5 of its long-run effect, whereas in stocks, it takes longer, and it's probably related to the short versus long-term way we treat capital gains. You have to, as most of you know, you have to leave a stock equity in the market more than 12 months in order to pay the 15% capital gains. Otherwise, you have to pay on your full tax rate, which in a lot of cases is double that. The immediacy of the response to gains in housing wealth means that housing produces a quicker lift to the economy. The model of consumer spending on which this study is based also suggests that liquidation of home equity and realization of capital gains from home sales can add significantly to growth of consumer spending in the short term. Again, big deal in Minnesota. Huge. Unlike the lasting impact that gains in housing and stock wealth have on consumer spending, the impacts of home equity extraction and realized capital gains are only temporary, and their statistical significance is not as great as that of housing wealth. So the issue is, borrowing against your house, that helps in the short term. But the real issue is keeping the housing value as high as we can, because, again, cash out-wise, when somebody sells, when somebody goes into a nursing home, when somebody needs cash, the house becomes an annuity. You can do a reverse equity mortgage, and it becomes a way to keep yourself taking care of yourself. And this is a fabulous difference between today and 30 years ago, or 10 years ago, where there were no such instruments as reverse equity mortgages. And by the way, those homes then are sold. And if a person dies prior to getting all the equity, obviously the state gets it, and that's not taxed. That's tax-free as well. But those homes are then sold at a discount because the bank doesn't want to hold them, or the lender doesn't want to hold them. So those homes actually provide a little bit more affordable housing. During the past 5 to 9 years, depending upon the area and the state in which you live, housing has added substantially to consumer spending and helped Minnesota weather the national recession. In some of your areas, greater Minnesota, where Representative Anderson's district, I fish up in his district a lot, obviously a strong paper economy, a strong wood economy matters the most. And things are doing well, thank goodness, because commodities are strong. But the fact of the matter is that if you drive around the lakes as often as I do, there are no such things as cabins anymore. These are people have put up these huge places, and as the baby boom retires, there's going to be more of it. And meaning they're going to sell their houses in towns, Duluth and so on. They're going to sell their places. They're going to take cash out. They're going to go buy a cabin and retire in greater Minnesota, which is going to help that economy, and they're going to have a bunch of cash at the end of it to live on. I mean, it's unbelievable. And again, I'm not an optimist, for those of you who know. I'm a very depressed guy. So this is wonderful. It made me feel the best I felt in years to read the study, and that's why I appreciate your letting me visit with you, because, you know, things are going to be hard here, but why not relish something that you all had something major to do with? The contribution of these housing-related factors to four-quarter growth in personal consumption expenditures climbed steadily from near 0 in 95 to 1.2 by the third quarter of 2003. In the third quarter of 2003, half of the housing-related effects were traditional wealth effects. Nearly 80% of Minnesotans own a home of their own In addition to the important contributions that housing has made to the macroeconomy, housing remains the primary store of wealth for most Minnesotans. This is a correction on your pieces. I typed this, so I'm inept. It's not 55%, it's 25%. Home equity constitutes approximately 25% of household net wealth. So, again, I just would like to reiterate, we want to do everything we can to make sure that people have jobs, so that the more competition we have for jobs, the more jobs we have, the stronger the housing market stays, and the more wealthy people get, because the net wealth in housing is non-taxable. By the way, on a bipartisan basis, President Clinton was the key person on this deal. The Republicans and stuff went along with him, but he figured it out because He was approached by Republicans and Democrats, and you don't believe me, call Ramstead and ask him. He was approached, and they were all poor. They didn't have any money, so he came up with the deal. They all cashed out of their brownstones in Georgetown, ended up with a whole bunch of cash, and then re-bought things. So I do appreciate sometimes the baseness of politics. Nearly 80% of Minnesotans own a home of their own, with only half owning stocks and stock mutual funds, though the number owning stocks and stock mutual funds is significantly higher if we include pension funds, 401ks, etc., which we don't do very much here. We don't think about the fact that public employees, private employees, we all own stocks. We just, some of us don't buy them directly, but we all own them if you have a retirement or a pension fund. And by the way, those are all taxable on withdrawal at either 15% short-term gain or long-term, either 15% long-term gain or your marginal tax rate short-term gain. Fully 6 in 10 Minnesotans had more home equity than stock equity. Furthermore, housing wealth is far more broadly distributed across income levels than stock wealth. The top 1% of stockholders in 2001 held one out of every $3 of stock wealth, while the top 1% of homeowners had held the lesser one out of every $8 in home equity. Point being is that wealth in housing is much more broadly distributed than wealth in stocks and bonds. Very important issue. Home equity is particularly important to lower income households. This was one of the most amazing pieces of the study. Among homeowners with under $20,000 in income, and most of these are seniors, fully 75% have more home equity than stock equity. Furthermore, the median wealth of these low-income homeowners is 81 times greater than the median wealth of renters at comparable incomes. When we started into this boom, because Mr. Greenspan's lowering rates and you guys giving all that dough back, when we started into this boom, Minnesota was still a very high home ownership state. But in the, one of the things you're seeing now, and you'll hear from, I'm sure, Jack Horner before the session's over, is that there's a real softness in the rental market. And the reason, the predominant reason is that interest rates were so low that those people who are renting, who are smart people, figured out that it was cheaper for them to buy than it was to pay rent at 5% mortgages. So we sold a slug of people who were renting houses, and I'm hoping we'll end up sharing in some of this that couldn't have shared in it had Mr. Greenspan not lowered rates to that level, which, by the way, was a 45-year low. We haven't had rates that low in 45 years, which some people bought more were able to buy houses at 4 4 and 5/8, and if you're one of the 40% of Minnesotans who itemized, that's and you're a 28% or 30% taxpayer, that means you're only paying 3% for your mortgage. So, I mean, think about that. Borrowing $300,000 at 3%. I mean, it's unbelievable. Furthermore, the median wealth of these low-income homeowners is 81 times greater than I said that. Housing has also been an important anchor for household wealth. Minnesota and the nation's overall aggregate housing wealth is far less volatile than the nation's stock wealth, which is why, when you think about it, we don't like the property tax. And by the way, we all know that people don't like the property tax either. We all like the property don't like the property tax, but it's the most stable base of taxation we have. It fluctuates the least. Minnesota's classified property tax and the reforms of 2001 have added to this growth and stability. Since housing is also a leveraged investment, even small gains in home values can be large relative to the down payment invested in a home. In 2003, for example, 10% of all homeowners put less than 10% down on their home. Moreover, the loss incurred on a home, apart from credit reputation if a homeowner defaults, is limited to the amount invested in the home at purchase plus any equity extracted after purchase. In conclusion, housing is a unique investment because households can borrow against home equity at a favorable rate relative to unsecured debt to finance consumption and investment. They can buy a rental property, lake property, and we're trying to figure out right now how many Minnesotans who have cashed out of their homes, refinanced, have taken that money and gone out and bought an additional property in Minnesota, because I think that would be an important thing for us to know. Additionally, home equity loans and lines of credit have built-in tax advantages for the approximately 40% of Minnesotans who itemize. Home equity lines of credit and loans totaled about $1 trillion in the U.S. in 2003. Also in 2003, an estimated $139 billion of home equity was liquidated through cash-out refinancing, meaning people refinanced their houses and took all their home equity out and reissued the loan at, oftentimes half of the interest rate they were paying. So their payments not only didn't go up, and oftentimes they went down, plus they had a bunch of cash. For all these reasons, housing contribution to the household finances is unique and of great importance both to homeowners and the broader economy. And then this will be the most controversial part of this presentation. I'd like to try today to ask you to think about something a little differently than we normally do. And I'm not suggesting that we should use the property tax as the major source of raising money. I'm not suggesting that, because I think we need to fundamentally live within our means. But the tax classification system reduces the market value of a property, this is a home property, from its actual value to a slight percentage of that value. And the example I give you is a $100,000 home in Minnesota is taxed at 1%, and up to $500,000, and that's 1.25%. So therefore, you're going to figure tax, rather than a $100,000 market value, you figure the tax on $1,000. You look up the local tax rate, and for argument's sake, I use 200, and that means that you pay $2,000 in property tax. Now, that means your effective tax rate for that asset was 2%. So if you have a $10,000 increase in your property wealth, or a $5,000 or a $3,000, let's make it $500, you're only paying 2% tax on that increase, which is, again, non-taxable at cash out. And I'm not worried about home values going down in Minnesota unless we lose lots of businesses, unless we lose jobs. And things are looking healthy that way, so we have to be optimistic. And I think Minnesota's economy is going to be stronger and stronger as time goes on. Particularly, and I mentioned this last year, and I've been trying to pay as much attention as I can, particularly if this genome research with the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota starts paying dividends. And the other day we saw the first example of a Roseville company hooking up with Mayo doctors to start a manufacture of some device that I didn't understand, but it's going to do something fabulous for all of us. And we're going to see. I just didn't understand that. I'm not that bright. On what other asset class or income does a Minnesotan pay 2% effective tax rate? Now, I understand, and I'm sensitive to, and I say this sincerely, to the politics of the property tax. The politics of the property tax is it's a very transparent tax. It's a very visible tax. People have to write a check for it. But if we did an experiment and we made everybody in Minnesota pay their income tax monthly, I can guarantee you the property tax would become not a very big tax. So this isn't about, in my opinion, again, I know it's a little country, I really believe this. I think this deal is about starting to understand or trying to get all of us to believe that some taxes are very stable and sound, and we should try to keep them not from growing too much. But at the end of the day, a person gets to sell their house and keep from taxation up to $250,000 if they're single and $500,000 if they're married. So, and we're talking everybody in Minnesota who owns a house. And I'm not sure we're going to go much higher than 80% home ownership. That's pretty astounding. Plus, we have lots of people who, as I mentioned earlier, will move out of their homes and then move into their cabins, and they'll cash out of their cabins at some later date. So they're going to get home equity, I mean, they're going to get this increase of money twice. And finally, I just did a little back-of-the-envelope comparison just to argue, all of you know this, 6.5% if you went out and bought $100,000 something would cost you $6,500 in Minnesota sales tax. And on the income tax, if you earned an additional $100,000, you'd have to pay $35,000 in state and federal tax plus $9,000 in Social Security and Medicare. So the effective tax rate on home value increases is really small. And maybe we should rethink what we, and by the way, we believe what we believe, all of us, for the right reasons. Homes were not, they were not liquid. People could be taxed out of them. Now they're liquid. And I checked that out, that thinking out with Art Rolnick at the Federal Reserve, and he's been doing it, he's talking about it in his speeches too. Homes are now a liquid asset. You can tap them. Home equity, reverse mortgages, they're available as cash to you. They weren't in the past. So based on the arithmetic that I presented to you, I do think that it's time for us to change our collective minds about the property. I'm not saying we should use it and raise it. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we should just think it through more carefully. And again, I would stress the fact that if we change the income tax to 12 monthly payments, the property tax would pale by comparison. Your citizens would not be telling you. Even blue-collar, regular folks would not be complaining about their property taxes anymore. So I am here not to create problems. I'm here to try to suggest that there's a way that we can maybe work around the problems that we're facing by thinking about property tax differently. And thank you very much for your time and attention.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Dorfman. Representative Knobloch.
Well, I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Dorfman, you know, I guess I think you're mixing a little bit of apples and oranges here. I'm wondering, would you feel that we should also implement a tax on all stocks that are pledged on which you borrow money against, or any other equipment on which you borrow money against? Because that's basically what you're saying we should do with home equity here.
Mr. Chair, what Representative Knobloch, I'm not following.
Well, Mr. Dorfman, you're saying that the value of an asset that you have goes up, you're able to borrow money against it, and you're saying we should implement a tax of some kind against the money that you pull out of that asset or are able to pull out of that asset. And I'm saying, what's the difference between equipment you have or stocks you have or something else that you've got the capability of borrowing money on too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I am not suggesting that you levy a tax against it. I'm telling you that it's a fabulous benefit to consumers that they don't have to pay a tax on it. And I sure don't want you to levy a tax on it. And as a matter of fact, I want less taxes. But right now, I'm suggesting that the property tax may not be as horrible a place. For example, in this poll I will hand out to you that we asked the Terrence Group in Washington, D.C. to do for us, which is a Democratic-Republican pollster. We tried to be very neutral in this. In this poll, it was shocking to me personally because I thought people would say income tax was the tax they prefer because of the old argument that we all used to make, that it's more progressive. In fact, people in Minnesota said fees. They liked fees the most. And you know why? I'm convinced. Because fees are direct. This is the reason they hate the property tax. Because fees are directly in their face. They know what they're getting. And meaning you pay $28 for a fishing license. You know you can go fishing and catch as many fish as you want. Whereas the public no longer trusts us, and I include myself in this because I have enormous respect for you guys. This is very hard work. They don't trust us when we say we're going to do something for them. Because it doesn't work out the way we say it's going to. They just don't believe it. And so I'm just here to do what I do, which is, I guess, be a little controversial, but also to, in earnestness, say, let's try, because we've got to resolve this impasse and figure out a way to do something on a bipartisan basis, because the people of Minnesota, they don't care about Republicans and Democrats, in all fairness to all of you. They care about whether their budget's balanced and they can show up and go, take their kids to hockey, and, you know, that's what they care about. And so you'll notice in the poll, it's fascinating things. 37% of Minnesotans think the most important issue is K-12 education. That happens to equal the number of people in Minnesota who have kids in school. When I started here 23 years ago, it was 73%. 73% of Minnesotans thought that was the highest, most important issue. And again, we didn't invent these questions to get some terrible answer. We invented them to help try to help you out. And it turned out to be amazingly accurate from what I've been thinking has been going on. So,
well, Mr. Chair, let me just end by saying I appreciate Mr. Dorfman, you're challenging us to think about things differently, and I think that's good. And I obviously appreciate the work you do for the Association of Realtors. I guess I think that you're mixing a little bit of apples with oranges, though, when you say that a one-time sales tax of 6.5% on a one-time purchase of something is somehow related to a 2% ongoing property tax on some increase in the price of property that would occur year after year after year, as opposed to on a one-time basis. And you're kind of arguing that we should almost go to an accrual system of taxation then, that when stocks go up, people pay some percentage of how much their stocks went up that year. When stocks go down, they deduct some percentage of what their stocks went down that year, because you're saying you've got the ability to pull the increase in your homeowner's property increase out in the form of debt. You know, if you've got that same ability for stocks or something else, why wouldn't it be any different? I appreciate what you're saying, but I think you're mixing apples with oranges.
Mr. Chair, just so I want to straighten out what I said so I'm more clear. Stocks do not have the capital gains exclusion that homes do. So what I'm trying to ask you to look at more than one piece here. There's the piece of home equity borrowing. That's interesting. It's helpful in terms of spending and stimulating the economy. The bigger issue is 40% of Minnesotans get to deduct their mortgage interest, their property taxes. Okay? At the end of the day, home equity, one of the reasons we're seeing push on home prices as well, is that this tax advantage that was given to us in 97 has said that this class of asset is going to be treated differently than stocks and bonds. So my point is that at the end of the day, you get the cash out of your house and keep whatever it is your house is worth when you paid it off or whatever you want to do it for nothing. You pay no state and federal tax. That's what makes this argument different than what you're saying, Representative Knobloch. Stocks do not have a capital gains exclusion. If they did, you would be right. But because the assets would be treated equally. What I'm trying to get everybody to focus on is this is an asset that the federal government has decided to treat so differently than any other asset that we have, so differently, that to the point where people are not only stimulating the economy through borrowing against this, but they're also using it to buy other Minnesota assets like cabins and hopefully commercial property. I mean, obviously, I represent realtors, so I want many transactions. It's in our interest. It's in our interest to have the state have the healthiest possible property and business market we can, because the more pressure there is on demand, the better the supply gets.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to finish it off, you know, I guess...
Representative Knobloch...
You
can have these esoteric conversations with with Mr. Dorfman at some other time. I mean, the point here. I think we get orange apple when we squeeze this fruit. But anyway...
No problem, Mr. Chair.
I comprehend. We have a couple other people, and then... Members, we do have a couple of pieces of legislation that are very important we want to hear about today. So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I don't see a specific proposal before us, I actually hear Mr. Dorfman bringing forward an idea that actually begs a fundamental question about what role each tax should play in our economy and our revenue system. So, Mr. Chair, I just want to ask the members of this committee and you, Mr. Chair, to support a proposal that I've brought forward to the Tax Reform Action Commission. It essentially sets forth a commission to look at the questions in a long-term and wide-ranging approach of whether we really have struck the right balances of taxes in our revenue system here in Minnesota for the changing economy and changing demographics that we do have. So it's just kind of an advertisement, Mr. Chair, in support of Mr. Dorfman as well. And thank you, Mr. Dorfman, for bringing forward ideas that challenge us. I appreciate it.
Can I just mention one other thing, Mr. Chair, that Representative Broad reminded me of?
Mr. Dorfman.
We had a conversation earlier this year, and I think you've already passed it, the governor's recommendations on closing corporate loopholes. I was thinking the other night that I'm 58 years old, and by 76 some years or so, I'd like to retire. And I was thinking about how what older people have done, smart older people, have done over the years in terms of investments. And you can look a lot of this stuff up. And you'll notice that in Minnesota, a lot of people, because this is a high-tax state, you'll notice that a lot of people in Minnesota, very wealthy people, have bought tax-free municipal bonds. Now, I don't own any of them. And I was thinking about that as a corporate loophole. So that's a kind of a bipartisan problem, meaning people buy them in the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul. They buy them in their own cities. And that benefits the city. But it also benefits the rich. And I'm all for keeping people as wealthy as possible so that they can take care of themselves and their families and they don't need government to help them and target the government resources to the most needy, which I thought was the point of all this. So I want to be very clear that I'm not arguing to raise the property tax. I'm arguing to live within your means, but to think about the property tax in a different way, that's all. That it's not – what makes it difficult is that it's in people's faces. They have to write the check. They don't hate it. any more than they hate any other tax they pay. It's just harder for them to escape it because they have to pay it in a check twice a year. That's all I'm saying.
Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to say I strongly agree with Representative Broad and also what Representative Lincheski brought up yesterday in looking at the long term on some of these budget items or just how we're going to do things. So I side with you on that. First of all, Mr. Dorfman, thank you so much for bringing up all the various ways in which housing really helps the economy. And I think that's a good message for a lot of cities outside the regional centers and the urban centers where housing is in fact economic development, because a smaller city may waste a lot of time chasing that smokestack they may never get or may not want, and yet the real economic development is in the housing and the tax base and putting kids in the schools and so forth. So I think that's a great point for that. The one question I had is you talk about property taxes. When the state took over education, of course, it moved reliance on funding for property taxes, the sales and income tax. What's your feelings about that? Would you support going back to like the general ed levy where you're placing more back on property taxes? What's your feeling on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, frankly, we shouldn't be in this position, and I know you guys have made some political hay on it, but the fact is we entered a recession at the wrong time. And all of us who supported having the state pay for education because of the constitutional mandate of the state being responsible for education assumed that the economy was going to continue to roll along. We have ups and downs in the economy. I would say, no, we shouldn't put it back on the property tax. I would say that the state should, in my case, our members' opinion, since they paid both sides of Social Security, they pay their own health care, right? They're not earning tons of money. Our folks believe that you should take the, let's say it's not 8%, let's say it's 4%, because you put $650 back into the reserve and you have $350 in the cash flow account. So you have $1 billion of money that you don't have to leave there. In past, we haven't left it there. And we should fund, if education is the most important issue around the table, then that's what you should, you know, you all do, because that's your job. But we can't do that and LGA and health care and roads. And we can't do that anymore. And what's frightening to me is that people don't see the demographics, is that the income tax isn't going to collect as much money. I've talked to Mr. Michael about this, and he's, you know, sobered me up a lot about saying, well, we don't know. It's hard to know. But as senior citizens get, as people get older, they get very smart about how to collect their income. And the taxes paid by senior citizens on very nice income is actually less than the taxes paid by the rest of us on similar incomes. People don't get that. So we're still living back in the 60s when we did have a baby boom that was expanding that we could tax with income tax, which all of us supported. But that base is eroding. When the baby boom retires, we're going to find every tax shelter we can to keep from paying income tax. And the bottom line is we've got to think about, I believe, I really, when I said earlier, and you know this, I mean, I've been here 23 years, I really care about this place. I love the institution, and we're at a crossroads. And we can't just keep saying, oh, we're going to do it the way we used to do it, because it doesn't work. It's not working. We're going to have economic ups and downs, right? This state sitting at the beginning of what I think is going to be a burgeoning of biotechnology businesses. I think the governor and many of you who have brought it up before are right. We are sitting at the time where we might see a Highway 128 like there is in Boston or Silicon Valley develop between Highway 52. I don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. We're the finest healthcare state in the United States, and we should be the finest healthcare state in the world. And I think in the next 20 years, we will be. I don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. Nothing. So, that's the deal.
You have any parting words?
Hey, no, I just really appreciate
Representative Rukavina, we got to move on here. We got two bills to hear, so
no.
We can have...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Rukavina.
No, come on, now.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You gave them the opportunity to come before the committee.
Mr. Dorfman, you have any final words?
No, but I'm happy to chat with Representative Rukavina at any time. I certainly will do that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina, we have two other pieces of important legislation to hear about today.
I
and
know
so.
That. So why did we have to listen to this? I had a hard, my ears couldn't keep up to his tongue. So why did, you know, we have to listen to this?
That's why he gave it to you.
I still don't understand the point. And I just, Mr. Chair, would like a few seconds to comment on a lot of generalities. You know, first of all, Mr. Dorfman, I spend a lot more time on those lakes up north by me and Mr. Anderson than you do. And I know I can show you many of those places where there's cabins, and there's real cabins. And they're going to be gone because they can't afford to keep the real cabins. But, you know, to hear you talk about smart older people buying municipal bonds and implying that the other ones, I guess, aren't so smart, when I can show you when you come up hunting or fishing next time in that boat that's worth more than most of the houses in Eblith are selling for, we'll go around and I'll bring it to some of these dumb older people who make $700 a month because they're stuck, their widows stuck in a pension where their husbands worked 40 years for U.S. Steel or LTV, and they don't have the wherewithal, and they never have had the wherewithal to buy municipal bonds. So, I sit here, it's unbelievable. All of a sudden you change the Constitution. You've been here 23 years. The Constitution mandates to provide for education. No, it mandates for equal education, not to provide for education. You know that, Dorfman. So you tell me how we helped equalize education by taking over Edina's property taxes, which you pushed. And now Edina offers 8 world languages. Look it up on their website. We're barely able to offer English in rural Minnesota. But we got 8 world languages in Edina. Minnetonka has 23 varsity football coaches. And they're putting a dome over their artificially turfed football stadium. And we took over their property taxes, and we don't even have football. We got 9-man football in a lot of places because we can't find the kids to have 11-man football anymore. So don't talk to me about equal education, Glenn. Uh-uh. That's not, it says equal education. It doesn't say provide for education. And when you can offer 8 world languages in Edina and put a dome over a football stadium, and Hennepin, Minneapolis school districts closed how many schools this year? And we're closing them left and right. No, don't talk to me about the favors you did from rural Minnesota and liquid. My house, I knock on the walls, and my hand doesn't go through it. It's solid, not liquid. It's the only asset a lot of people have to pass on to their kids. And 2 years ago, we took that asset away. Said if you had a life estate, it doesn't count anymore in Minnesota. No, You know, the more you talk around here, the more it hurts my district. And the more you push your bills about a house is a house and everything else and providing for equal education or for taking over education, the more it hurts the people I represent. So that's all I'm going to say, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Thank you, Mr. Dorfman. And now, members, the chair will move House File 705, and we're going to, we might as well move House File 760 as well. We're to Representative Lincheski and Representative Abrams. We have discussion this morning, members, on a very important topic, the single sales apportionment of the corporate franchise tax. So, two of our more learned members in this on this topic. So Representative Lincheski, do you want to defer to the senior member of the tax committee, or do you want to you want to be first at bat?
Whatever anybody would like. I think, Mr. Chair, we should go. I have the lower bill number, but we're probably going to talk about single sales, and I have introduced single sales legislation the last few years. This year I did actually not a true single sale, the 95-5, but I think for the purposes of discussion of the committee, we'll talk about single sales anyhow, so we should probably work off Representative Abrams' bill.
All right. So, Representative Abrams, to House File 760.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and it's certainly an honor to have Glenn Dorfman as the warm-up act. just to get the juices flowing. Currently, members, the Minnesota corporate franchise tax is apportioned according to a formula based upon three factors. One factor is sales in the state. The second is payroll in the state, and the third is property owned in the state. When the apportionment factors for the corporate franchise tax first went into effect in the late 1930s, Minnesota was a trailblazer in trying to have it based upon sales. And it makes sense, because if you're taxing payroll and if you're taxing property, you are in fact taxing job creation. If you take a look at the fiscal note, which is always subject to revision, one of the interesting things about going to 100% based upon sales is if you look on the second page, there will be the savings to Minnesota corporations, but the cost to non-Minnesota corporations. And the reason that Minnesota corporations save money under this is because they have payroll in the state. And the reason that non-Minnesota corporations will have to pay more is when you go away from the sales factor, go to a single sales factor away from property and from payroll, they're going to have to pay more. So it's a little bit like a couple of other taxes, like the gross receipt tax on insurance companies, that you can have a tax decrease on Minnesota domiciled companies and an increase on others. The witnesses are going to go over some of the reasons for the bill and some of the actions in other states. And there's been a move in other states over a period of years to move to the single factor based upon sales. As a matter of fact, I believe just yesterday, the state of New York passed and is sending to Governor Pataki a single sales formula for the state of New York. I understand that Georgia is moving in the same direction. The governor's proposal that was part of the presentation by the Department of Revenue showed an eight-year phase-in. House File 760 is what I would call the big bang factor. It would do it all at once. It may be a question of our eyes being bigger than our stomach. But I think that this is an important issue in order to attract and retain jobs in Minnesota, to have the hometown advantage, if you will, to have payroll in Minnesota and to have property in Minnesota and to be a national and global competitor with sales outside the state. With that, I think we're ready for witnesses. Representative Luchesky, or do you have something to add?
Representative Luchesky.
I'll just add something to that, because I think the witnesses are here, and Representative Abrams has summed it up just fine. I did want to point out that somebody, not me, passed out this math, so it's a good thing to refer to during the discussion. What Representative Abrams said is exactly right. You know, we were a leader in the nation. We are now, we don't have a home state advantage anymore. And we need to get that home state advantage back. Most economists believe that most of the nation will go to this fairly quickly, and then we will be really behind what's happening nationally. I do want to say that really the policy thing behind single sales is the job creation component. It eliminates tax advantages for leaving the state of Minnesota. It's neutral to 100% Minnesota companies now, but it certainly makes some businesses pay more tax and some pay less. But it's rewarding folks by taking capital out of the equation and taxing sales. So I think we want to be interested collectively that to have more jobs in Minnesota, reward people for not leaving Minnesota, and help these companies stay right here.
Okay. Witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Steve Tufte. I'm from Lou Rich, located in Albert Lea, Minnesota. Last year I was introduced as Dan Dorman's neighbor, and yes, that's still the case. And actually, I've had a couple of people ask about the condition of your yard. I can't quite understand that. So my response is there's not much mowing beside the when he goes around the trees and the rocks. So there. A little history on Lou Rich and some of our sister companies. Lou Rich was established in 1972 by two gentlemen who are from Hayward, which is a small town near Albert Lea. And that's where the Lou and the Rich came from the name. We have a couple sister companies. We're all based out of Albert Lea, which is located on the Iowa border. We have four locations in Albert Lea. Two of them are manufacturing sites. Two of them are office. And we do have a facility in South Dakota and a recent thing in Mexico also. We have 375 total employees. And of those, we have 340 of them are located in Minnesota. So we have predominance of our assets as far as payroll, and our buildings are located in Minnesota. Sales-wise, when referring to this bill, we do a fair amount of sales outside of the state. In fact, the majority of our sales is out of state. We do a lot of our sales in Iowa and Wisconsin, which are, as you can see on the map there, and a number of states in the west and on the east coast. So a number of things there. Relating to physical on those payroll and the building property side, actually 90% of our payroll and our assets are located in Minnesota. And so we have a large establishment down in the Elberlee area as far as where we're located for assets and our payrolls. One thing I'd just like to point out to members here is we're an ESOP, and that stands for an Employee Stock Ownership Plan. And actually 70% of our companies are owned by the employees, and the other 30% is actually owned by former and current employees. So we are very truly an employee-owned company. So when things impact our company, whether it's taxes or other things, all our employees really feel the effect, and they feel the benefit and on their assets, if you will, from their involvement within the company. We've grown significantly in the last 10 years. We used to be 160 employees. Now we're up to 375. We've seen a lot of growth, and that's all coming in Minnesota, basically, with addition of plant and payroll as far as the company is concerned. So a lot of things there. We do a lot of capital improvements. In the last 5 years, we've averaged about $2 million a year in capital improvements, and along with that goes the payroll side of things that... as you can all understand. One thing we see, and I think that really comes to bear fruition for this, what's being considered here is we're a contract manufacturing company predominantly. What that means is we provide parts and assemblies to original equipment manufacturers. And we have a fair amount of our sales in the medical industry. We have a number in the agricultural side. And being so close to Iowa, you can guess that's probably at the John Deere facilities. And also Scotsman Ice system. So we provide them with parts and assemblies, and we do have some of our own lines of equipment that we do sell also in the industrial and automotive areas. The main thing I guess I want to point out there is in providing services to those companies, we're a very cost-competitive industry. They look not only at U.S. companies when they're considering where they want parts manufactured, where they want suppliers and so forth, they're also looking internationally. We often compete when we're getting quotes from companies in Mexico, China, you've got Eastern Europe to consider, let alone other U.S.-based companies. And what we find is the only way that we're going to end up competing with them is when we invest in capital-type improvements, new machinery, buildings, and better trained employees so we can compete effectively with them and keep our costs down as low as possible level. And that provides us the opportunity to compete against these international ones and keep that type of business in Minnesota and growing. And so we find that's the real key for us going forward in the future is to be able to provide those types of things and be competitive on price and quality and delivery and so forth to these companies. So that's where the real impact is on us as far as for us to provide those kind of things, make those types of investments, and this is we're being considered just another benefit as far as our growth and what it provides for that. So that's kind of a brief summary as far as the company where we really see the impact. But again, for us to compete internationally and really make the investments for competing against some of those, this is just another plus as far as helping that type of thing. Any questions from any of the Mr. Chairman or any of the committee members?
Committee members, any questions of the witness? If not, thank you very much, and maybe you could help Representative Dorman out with that lawn care situation. he's been rather busy lately.
Yes, I understand that. So.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Abrams.
I understand that. There's also a dog that has helped himself to some of Representative Dorman's pork chops that may be involved here.
I'll let Dan elaborate on that.
Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chair, we, Mary Jo and I own actually I think one of the more expensive black labs in the state because when the boys were old enough to say they wanted a dog, and Mary Jo wanted an outside dog, and kind of spiraled down to a new house. And so it turns out we bought by Tufty there, and we built a house, and I didn't need a dog because it came with the property. There was a chocolate lab out there that that spends a lot of time at our house, and I think they've got a diet over there on him at the Tufty household, but he does enjoy pork chops fresh or grilled. He's a good companion and does spend a lot of time at the house, only rivaled by the amount of time my youngest son spends at his house. I think there was some kind of a trade for Kramer and Matthews.
Mr. Chairman, we also
Representative
have
Abrams.
Tom Cotswold from the Metquist Companies is also here, who headquartered in my district but also has installations throughout the state.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but representatives. Although Representative Abrams does live in the district that Metris Companies headquarters is in, I've never been to his home, so I can't comment on the status of his lawn or or dog, for that matter, either. My name is Tom Gottwald. I'm Vice President of Taxes of Metris Companies, which is based in Minnetonka. We do also have a call center facility in Duluth that has about 120 or so employees. Metris is not a household name, and many people don't know what we do, but we are the nation's 10th or 11th largest credit card issuing company. We have about $6 billion of credit card receivables. That's down from about $12 billion when we were at our peak about 2 years ago. As many of you might know from reading some of the articles about our company in the paper, we went through a severe profit crunch a while back and are now about half the size of what we used to be in terms of company size. So we're now slowly returning to profitability and are being very careful and prudent about when we add new employees and where we add them to be most effective and make sure that we get the best productivity out of our employee and capital additions. We've got facilities, as I mentioned, in Duluth at our headquarters in Minnetonka, but we've also got facilities in Florida, Oklahoma, and Maryland, as well as our credit card issuing bank and some operations in Arizona, Phoenix, Scottsdale area as well. So we're fairly well diversified geographically, but our headquarters are here. This is a complex issue that some of you may know more about than others, but it's sort of a convergence between tax policy and economic development policy, and it really does have an impact on jobs. And listening to Mr. Dorfman speak, I think he said one of the biggest fears that he had was that the jobs would decline in Minnesota, and as long as that doesn't happen, he remained optimistic about the housing market in Minnesota. And I think this is an instance where the tax policy and the effect on jobs converge and could have an impact on that, because the as Representative Abrams said, it really Minnesota has slipped behind the rest of the country in this area. We used to lead it, and now we're falling further and further behind. So in our instance, because of our unique status as a financial services organization, and I'll get a little bit more into the tax aspect maybe than looking at this purely from a jobs perspective, but the tax rules for apportioning that Representative Abrams spoke about are slightly different for financial services institutions, in that the property factor is not just the tangible property of the headquarters building or the equipment that a company might own. It's the intangible assets of the receivables. So in our case, because we're nationally diversified in terms of where our customer base is and where our sales are, only about 1.4% of our company's property factor is in Minnesota. But about 41% of our payroll factor is in Minnesota. And as a result, about 79% of our company's Minnesota income tax is driven solely by the payroll factor, which is a bit unusual for a typical manufacturing company. But that's how dramatic this current provision has or is for our company. So it's a very big item for us. If you took our company and took it lock, stock, and barrel, the headquarters and the Duluth facility, and moved them to Iowa, our apportionment factor to our headquarters state would be 1%. As it is with our headquarters and our facility in Duluth in Minnesota, it's 6.5%. That's the dramatic difference that we have. So for every $1 million of payroll that Metris adds in Minnesota, it increases by 5 basis points its proportion of income that gets taxed in the state. So for us, it's a pretty dramatic impact and largely driven by the payroll factor. And I guess in the interest of brevity, that's all I'll probably say for now. The other states to follow up on Representative Abrams' mentioning of New York and Georgia include Connecticut, Arizona, and Alabama are also moving very rapidly towards single sales factor currently in this legislative session. And with that, I'll thank the chairman and representatives and would be available for any questions.
Questions for the witness? Okay, Representative Abrams, I'm sorry.
I do have a something that may help the committee consider this as we go forward. Minnesota's corporate franchise tax, I believe, is the highest in the nation at the 9.9%. The flip side of that is that we have an apportionment formula that used to lead the nation based upon sales. We have foreign operating companies in order to hopefully encourage exports, although it may have been used for more than that. We have R&D credits to and repatriation provisions, which act as incentives for corporations to be located here. If you're going to be a high tax rate state, you need things like the single sales factor in order to get companies to say that it doesn't cost us that much more to be headquartered or add or do business in Minnesota. I think what this is about is paying a fair share and not paying many-fold a fair share. If you look at the entire picture, including the corporate tax rate.
Representative Abrams, maybe you could enlighten us a little bit with regard to how businesses, as other states move to single sales apportionment, that what the double taxation rate may be in the state of Minnesota for a company that does significant amount of sales in some other states.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, based upon the apportionment formula, it is possible to pay more than 100% of your income in taxes. Strange to believe, but it is true. Just given that in the case of Metris, they're paying 5% in Minnesota, but if you took a look at their other
6.5%,
but if you take a look at some other states, when you added it all up, it is possible that they could be at 104 or 105%, and that becomes the reason that our friend here has a job, is to try to manage that in order to pay the lowest rate. And lest anybody thinks that this does not have a significant impact on headquarter locations, etc., it was very shortly after Illinois went to the single sales factor that Boeing moved their headquarters from Seattle to Chicago. There are some other business factors that were involved, but one of the driving forces behind it what was the single factor, because Washington does not have a corporate income tax. So that's kind of the competitive environment that you're dealing with. The CEOs and the CFOs and the public outside directors have a whole list of things that they look to in order to make location decisions, expansion decisions, and unfortunately, occasionally, contraction decisions. And how income is taxed is one of those factors. It is not necessarily the controlling factor, but it's one of those factors. And as other states move towards the single factor of sales, we have to make sure that we are at least in the ballpark of competitiveness if we're going to have those decisions come out the way we want to for our economic future.
Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, when all our states reach 100%, we're going to be in the same position as we are before we started, with Minnesota having high corporate rates. Are we any better off then? How quickly will that happen? Next 5 years?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, you are into a very important area of taxation policy that there have been academic treatises written on. with the advent of limited liability companies and partnerships and all sorts of pass-through entities, and even the ability to go to public markets with these entities, it is becoming less advantageous to be a subchapter C corporation because of the corporate franchise tax. This is not a partisan sort of issue, Representative Earhart. I know that Senator Rest and I have discussed if there should be a corporate franchise tax. There are four states that don't have it. I don't mean to disparage them, but I don't normally think of these states as leading lights as far as tax policy or states that I would like to emulate ourselves after, although others may. But I think long term, we may be looking at some sort of business taxation that does not pick and choose your tax situs based upon your tax status, excuse me, based upon the form in which you have decided to organize.
Any follow-up, Representative Earhart?
I'm not sure I answered my question, but okay.
I think I said yes, Representative Earhart.
Okay.
I think what the answer was is the next step is to remove the corporate franchise tax, which some states are already moving in that direction. So, Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add the same that the Chair just did. And there are many of us who support abolishing the corporate franchise tax completely for the reasons laid out. And I think that that's a discussion the Minnesota legislature will have in the next 10 years, and there's ways to do it. We heard Growth and Justice was in here saying the same thing, and they'd like to move it all to the individual income. We've had members who have looked to move all that taxation to fees. We've had members who want to do a VAT tax, business activity tax. But it is something, I think, that when all the states get to 100%, and you're absolutely right, Representative Earhart, that it begs the question why we have a corporate franchise tax. And if we didn't have one, we wouldn't even have these bills right now. So it will be a debate in the future.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for either Representative Lucheski or Abrams, or perhaps both. In this area, I agree with both of you. I think we need to do something. I took a peek at the governor's plan. It's quite a bit short of what this is. I think the other one is the AMT. I think we need to do something there. And so as I've looked at a couple different things this session, I thought, well, I better figure out how to write the check for some of the things that I'm up to. And I have got a bill in that would expand sales tax on the clothing to pay for them. And so I'm curious, you know, Governor, I think his revenue estimate would be about $1.8 million on the single factor. This one is $130 million over the biennium. I'm just curious if you have thoughts yet of you know, how we should pay for these items.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. And I think, you know, we're getting a little aside of the bill, but I do want to answer that question. And I agree with you, Representative Dorman. I'm sorry you weren't in committee yesterday, and I gave the pitch for the income tax increase. So we all have taxes. Not all of us, I shouldn't say that. There are a bunch of people who don't want to vote for any tax increases. I'm not one of them. I just want to vote for the right ones. And if you're asking me personally, and Representative Abrams can answer his own, I've been on the record repeatedly saying we ought to have raised the cigarette tax by now. I voted for gas tax increases, and it's time to look at income. I do, however, think we can balance the budget without a tax increase if we had political will on both sides of the aisle to take a new look at the budget. Doesn't appear that anybody's willing to do that on either side, really, truthfully, in a sincere way. Representative Marquardt has said this repeatedly, and I agree with him, that what we ought to do is really assess if everything we've been doing since the beginning of time is worth doing. But people don't want to go there, so I think we either have to do gimmicks, gambling, or taxes. I'm willing to work with everybody on what that's going to be, so I think your question is legitimate, and we all need to figure that out.
Some of us, Representative Lucheski, believe in prudent fiscal management of the state's resources, neither gambling gimmicks nor tax increases. So,
well, Mr. Chair, I think, though, if I may, that's what I was saying. I would say, Representative Krenke, you're the real thing. You have done that. You're willing to say, let's not raise taxes, but let's cut stuff. And that's real. And then there's other folks here who want to spend more, and they'll raise taxes. But the complication comes in the people who aren't willing to take that hard look, and you've been consistent. You've said we can find more to cut. I just don't think, realistically, with this two-party system we've got in the current situation we're in, that we've got a majority of legislators who agree with one side or the other. And so, therefore, we are still left with the gimmicks, gambling, or taxes. I really think that's what we're stuck with.
Representative Linchesky, cut is such a cruel word. I mean, let's get it down to realistic. It's reduce the increases in expenditures. We are not cutting government guaranteed. I think we all know that. We may not be satisfied with the amount of increases in certain areas, but I don't think we're cutting anything. So, but anyway... Representative Abrams, you want to increase the you want to put a sales tax on clothing?
You know, Mr. Chairman, when you take a look at, I believe there are 104 exemptions in the sales tax. We have the third highest rate in the nation, state sales tax. We have one of the narrowest bases. And although the sales tax on clothing as a swap out is not very high on my list, I suspect that with a little effort, Representative Dorman, there are other things in the sales tax area that could get some bipartisan support that are relics of the past. And we might even add a little bit of rationality to the sales tax if that's possible. But, you know, if you take a look at bill introductions, Mr. Chairman, there will always be new sales tax exemptions every year. And it's going to be for good causes. And at the end of the day, it just starts to riddle the sales tax area. There are things we can look at, Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it seems to me that that sales tax in Minnesota was put on over the wishes of a governor. In fact, I think they overrode his veto in order to put the sales tax in place there, isn't it?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I just spoke the other night with the author of that bill, a former state representative, Bill Frenzel, was the author of that bill. And he's lived to be a ripe old age. nobody got him yet.
Okay, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify either in favor or in opposition to either House File 705 or House File 760? Anyone else? If not, members, Chair will lay over House File 705 and House File 760 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much. Appreciate your coming. And now, members, we have obviously taken more time than we had anticipated today on the previous topics, so I do want to give an appropriate amount of time to the discussion on the alternative minimum tax, again, an issue of extreme importance. So, Representative Abrams and Representative Linchesky, Chair, again, will move House File 711 and House File 845 for discussion and possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So, Representative Linchesky, since Representative Abrams took the lead last time, we'll give you the opportunity to lead this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking for the right file. Sorry about that.
And again, members, we are going to run over a little bit here because I do want to, we have witnesses and we have presentations from the CPAs, so I do want to give them ample opportunity if members can delay their other appointments and schedules a bit. So, Representative Linchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if a page could pass this out, I do want to tell members just really quickly that I think there's about 15 handouts been passed around on AMT, and there's the thick thing, and I know the CPA has brought all that information. I haven't passed any of that out. I don't think Representative Abrams has either. So that's separate, but I know we'll get to that. I do want to just pass this one item out, and you can tell how bad my copying skills are because I forgot to put the date. I cut that off, but it was in the last couple weeks that the Star Tribune opined about this serious issue, so I thought I'd bring that with. I think the committee understands the issue. I think you're running out of time, so I'll just say that you know, this, the bill I have repeals the alternative minimum tax. It makes it effective in 2005. It allows for outstanding alternative minimum tax credits to be applied against the regular tax years in 06 and 07. And repealing the tax alone, probably, I don't have my fiscal note here. I think it costs about $40 million a year and more in following years. But members, we understand, similar to single sales, that we probably can't do this all at once. Representative Abrams has taken a stab at kind of where we got to, I think, in 2004, which is trying to solve the problem for some of the people. And the alternative minimum tax, I think members know this, was designed to get the rich folks who didn't pay taxes. What's happened instead is over time it's getting the folks who aren't rich, and it's slowly moving the middle class into paying a much higher tax than they should be paying. This will continue to be a growing problem in Minnesota, as it is across the country. And so I introduced the bill again this year just to get a discussion piece going. And, Mr. Chair, I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, House File 711, how did I get 711? It should have been given to Westerberg for one of his gambling bills. House File 711 is a proposal from the CPAs dealing with the alternative minimum tax. And as members know, in Minnesota, you now have to fill out your income tax twice. First, on the M1 form, and then to see if, because of various deductions that you partake, if you are thrown into the alternative minimum tax. It kind of is almost a surprise at the end of the day. To answer Representative Earhart's question, even though he's not in the room, it's probably the best tax policy to eliminate the AMT. I don't think we're going to get there. But what House File 711 does is it hits on a number of the inflection points that can lower the number of people who are subject to the AMT, and it would also be disproportionately those in the $50,000 to $100,000 income category that would be taken off the AMT. The three areas in which it uses as levers is it increases the exemption amount from $40,000 to $45,000 for married filing jointly. It eliminates the, it allows an AMT mortgage interest deduction of up to $5,000 annually. That is probably the more problematic provision of the bill. And it also repeals the Chapman provision, and I've had a separate bill for charities dealing with that. I believe at the end of the day, with this bill, roughly half the taxpayers who are currently subjected to the AMT would not be. And again, it would be disproportionately those AMT filers at the $100,000 income level and below. We do have a couple of witnesses from the tax from the Minnesota CPA Society who can give you some more information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Jim DeLeiden. I'm a certified public accountant. Today I'm representing the Minnesota Society of CPAs. I am the current chair of the Minnesota AMT Task Force Committee. I'm a tax partner with Boulay, Whitmacher, Zabel & Company in Eden Prairie, and I'm currently enjoying my 28th tax season here in Minnesota. With that good background on the AMT, I think we can move ahead in the outline to perhaps page 5, which talks about why we should care about the AMT. We feel that the current policy is bad tax policy. The AMT has expanded far beyond the original intent of the law. We're seeing that more and more middle-class families are paying a tax that they were never intended to pay. There's also compliance issues. The Minnesota AMT is complicated, and if you don't use a professional tax preparer, there's a good possibility you will not even be aware that an AMT tax is owed. So we feel that a tax system that allows the middle class to inadvertently not be compliant is not good tax policy, and that's sort of what we have with the Minnesota AMT. Why should we care? The problem is going to get more and more expensive as we go along, with each passing year. The longer we wait to address the problem, the more of the middle class will be affected by this tax. We do have some real-life examples. These are real-life situations. The pictures in your outline are not the real people, but the first one is an individual that makes $38,000, lives in Shoreview. It's a single mom with one child. This individual paid a total of $441 in federal income tax and zero federal alternative minimum tax. However, when she did her Minnesota tax return, her tax was $1,341 in total. That's $900 more than the federal income tax, of which $568 of that was the Minnesota AMT. And if the House File 711 had been in effect at that time, then she would not have paid any AMT at all. Next example is a retired widow that lives in Edina. I'm on page 9. Her income is $57,000. She lives on Social Security, but she also had to sell some of her investments in order to for her living expenses. So that's how her income got into up to $57,000 due to capital gains. Again, her total federal income tax was $542, and she paid no federal alternative minimum tax. The Minnesota income tax she paid was a total of $949, again, higher than the total federal income tax, of which $381 was the Minnesota AMT. Next example, page 10. Here's a farmer in Truman, Minnesota. His total income was $23,830. He paid no federal AMT, and he did have Minnesota AMT of $237.
Could you I'm sorry, Mr. Gladden. Could you just give us an idea, seeing that my public school math skills are not up to par here, as to in these examples as to why these individuals did not pay any federal AMT?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. Several years ago, the federal government came out with the child tax credit for any children that are under 17 years old, and right now it's up to $1,000 credit. That does offset the regular income tax as well as the federal AMT tax. So people in that situation have seen their federal tax bill drop dramatically. But of course, the federal government doesn't have to buy and balance their budget every year, so like Minnesota does. So that's a big issue.
We're going to try and work on that here in 2007. So,
with regard to the widow in Edina, of course, she didn't have any children, but she was single, and so she exceeded the exemption amount, and because she had a mortgage and the other things that affected, that's what caused her to be an AMT. A more dramatic example, I would add, is on page 11. This is an individual who owns $60,000, lives in Deep Haven. The wife stays at home with her three young children. Doesn't work. Their federal tax in total was $679 and zero AMT tax at federal. But the Minnesota tax paid was $1,715, over $1,000 greater than the federal income tax in total, of which $739 was due to the Minnesota AMT. And the last example on page 12 deals with a big family, a married couple, both work outside the home. They earn $131,000 in income, and they've got four kids. They received a refund on a credit return of $3,000, but they actually had to pay Minnesota AMT of $500. That was their total tax bill, but it was all due to Minnesota AMT. And this is a concept that, you know, I think the taxpayers I talk to are focusing more and more on, that you know, all of these examples, the Minnesota tax in total was greater than the federal tax. I never used to see that 5 years ago. Now it's becoming more and more prevalent, and part of the reason is due to the Minnesota AMT. And I'm talking about the total tax liability, not the tax, the bigger refund or the or smaller refund or the bigger balance, due with the total Minnesota tax before payments compared to the federal tax. The Minnesota tax is larger for these middle-income people. And they have a hard time understanding that. Now I'll turn it over to Todd for some projections.
My name is Todd Koch. I am also on the Minnesota CPA's AMT Task Force. I am a tax partner of the firm John A. Knutson & Company, a CPA firm in Falcon Heights. We've been talking about these different people. The easiest thing for me to understand and explain is just talk about me. So what's really happening is the AMT exemption amounts have not been changed since the AMT was put in place in 1985. But economics have changed since 1985, as eloquently pointed out by the realtors. So if we take a look at what really happens is Minnesota exemption is $40,000. It's been $40,000 since 1985. 1985, myself, I'm married, I have three kids. So if I look at the exemptions in 1985, I get for married and three kids, that was $5,200. $1,040 a person. And now it's $15,500. So that means that the exemption, the amount that defines whether or not you're rich, are you taking too big of an advantage of a tax system, it's now been determined that I use $10,000 of my determining that I'm taking too large of advantage of the tax system by virtue of the increase in exemptions over time. The second part has to do with the home. I have a home in Shoreview. It was worth about $85,000 in 1985. According to the property tax statement, it's now worth $240,000. Back when I bought the house, my interest rate, I was lucky. I was at 8.75%, which was pretty low back then. My home mortgage interest, which isn't deductible for AMT, is about $7,400. In order to buy the same house today for $240,000, because it's a starter home, my interest now would be about $17,500. Again, I've used up a lot more of the exemption without just due to changing economics. Charitable contributions. In 1985, I could deduct all my charitable contributions. Now I have about $1,000 I can't deduct. Just by virtue of these things over time, what happened is, of the exemption, I originally would only use $12,600 of the exemption. I had $27,000 left to offset other things that the system was intended to capture. If I was taking too large of an advantage of the system, today I would only have $6,000 left, only 15% of the exemption. So what's happened is I've used up almost 85% of the exemption on things that the tax was never really designed to catch. And that's what House File 711 is trying to do. Get back the tax that was originally intended to do, to only affect certain taxpayers, not average people. And that's what's happening is the original AMT in 1985 had the sum total of 3,342 taxpayers that are impacted. Really not much. Not many people. Really wasn't much of a concern. 10 years later, there's only 5,300 people impacted. If we do nothing, we'll have 125,000 people impacted under current projections. So right now there isn't a million mom march out there trying to tell you that we need to fix this problem. It doesn't have that great growing constituency. We're just asking you to address the problem before the constituency has to show up here. The revenue that the AMT brings in, the revenue is the increase in the tax, not the total tax derived, was originally about $13 million. If we do nothing, if you think that addressing the problem today is difficult, try to address a $102 million problem. Just asking that you address the problem before it becomes insurmountable. We don't want to have what happens at the federal government happen here, where no one will address AMT because it's too expensive. Please address it before it is too expensive. The only thing that is dropping is the average collections for AMT taxpayer. This is not a slide you have in the materials. But originally you had identified the people you wanted to pay AMT. because the people paying AMT paid over, on an average, $4,000 per taxpayer. Well, by paying $4,000 per taxpayer, you had identified the people who are taking too large advantage of the system, and they were paying what you believe to be their fair share. The only thing that's dropping is the average collections per person. What it means is we're collecting tax from more people on the margin, people that weren't originally identified in the system. So even though the total revenue is going up, the revenue per person, per taxpayer, pardon me, is declining. So you're collecting tax from people who originally weren't intended, increasing complexity, having people have to hire people like myself and Mr. Zeliden, versus trying to do it on their own. The last part is just talking about the different components of the House file and their different revenue impacts. And here's what's going on at the federal level. The elephant that no one will deal with. It'll eventually become, it'll be cheaper to repeal the regular income tax system at the federal level than to fix AMT. That's why they will not deal with the system. They know it's a problem, and things can't be done. It is too large. They agree it's bad tax policy. They agree it's not transparent. They agree we're collecting tax from people who were never intended to collect tax from. However, how do you deal with the problem when it gets that large? Please address the problem before it gets that large. And this body has been very, very good about doing that. When we've made changes in the regular tax system, the AMT impacts have been identified so we don't exacerbate the problem. Federal government's not doing that, and that's what's part of what's getting here. But we can do a lot more, and we can make things better.
Mr. Blake. Okay, we'll just close with this issue is being highlighted both locally and at the national level. And I'm turning to slide number 21 now. The Star Tribune earlier this month indicated that Minnesota ranks sixth among states in the proportion of filers who pay the federal AMT. And because Minnesota has its own version of the AMT, some residents are finding themselves subject to a double dose of these higher taxes. They're paying both federal and Minnesota AMT. There's a tax preparer in St. Louis Park who indicated that until recently, he never had to calculate the AMT. During his 13 years, he'd been filing tax returns. But he said, once you're in it year after year. And that's a true fact. You know, I'm finding with many of my clients, if you're in AMT 1 year, unless you make a drastic change in your circumstances, you pay off your mortgage, for example, and it's hard to do that, or you cut back on your charitable contributions, you know, things we don't necessarily want them to do, you're going to find yourself in AMT year after year. Hitting middle-income people with a higher tax because they bought houses or had large families and gave money to charities isn't a tax policy that most Minnesota politicians would care to defend. Next slide, 22, quotes the New York Times, and this talks about the federal issue. And the reason we've got that in there is that, again, we don't want to get to the position that the federal government finds themselves in now. If we address the problem now while it's smaller, we can avoid the problem that they're in. The New York Times said that the alternative minimum tax by the year 2009 would produce more revenue than the ordinary federal income tax. Now that's quite a statement. They collect more money in federal AMT than they would in regular federal income tax. That's a huge statement. The triggers for the AMT have not kept up with inflation, causing it to capture many people whose main deductions come from nothing more exotic than children and local taxes. Page 23, in 2005, they estimate 3 million people will owe the federal alternative minimum tax. Under their projections, by the year 2010, that'll grow tenfold to 30 million people. And among the people, married filers that have children and make $75,000 to $100,000, that's sort of the sweet spot, 94% of these people will be in the federal AMT. Fortune magazine said if there was ever a part of the tax code that could use some serious public discussion, the AMT is it. The longer we wait, the tougher the discussion becomes on this issue. solutions. I believe House File 711 addresses many of the concerns, and I believe it eliminates 70% of the AMT taxpayers from the burden of the AMT once it's fully phased in. Any questions?
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify in favor of House File 711 or House File 845, or in opposition? Anyone in the audience? Okay. A familiar face.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question before I testify. Is this bill increase or decrease my tax take?
You have to talk to your tax preparer if you can.
If the bill increases my taxes, I'm against. If it decreases my tax, I'm for it. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity.
We need your name for the record.
Kenneth James McDonald, Carper County, formerly District 32A, former member of the Minnesota House of Representatives for 14 years. Pleased to be here to see you.
Thanks, KJ. Good to see you.
And current member of the Watertown City Council.
Ah, still holding public office. Glad to see you. I want to, if there's no one else who wants to testify again, any questions from members? If not, again, gentlemen, we thank you very much for taking time out of what we know is a very busy schedule for you this time of year. Appreciate your taking time to share this information with us. Members, if there's no further discussion, I'll lay over House File 711 and House File 845 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Members, just Representative Simpson, would you move the minutes from the previous two meetings?
So moved, sir.
Any additions, deletions, or discussion to the minutes from the previous meetings? Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I was here.
You were here.
Yeah. Get me not an excuse, and I might have been excused, but I think I was here anyway.
We appreciate your being here, both then and now. So we'll make that correction to the minutes on Tuesday, March 22nd. So, okay. If there are Representative the minutes, all those in favor of the minutes by as corrected, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those who are opposed, minutes are adopted. Representative Lincheski.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. I did see that the Regulated Industries Committee sent all the gaming bills to taxes. Is that right? I think, Chair. Yes. And do you have a plan for roughly when we should be preparing for those?
Not at this time. So we... I don't believe Representative Westerberg, I don't believe they have the bills have actually moved yet. I don't know what that may happen today during session.
Right.
So the earliest we could take them up would be next week.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lincheski.
I just raise it because I know it'll be a controversial day, and I hope that you'll... I know everything's getting so, you know, we're...
Controversy? Representative Westerberg, what kind of controversy did your legislation bring?
Really, I don't believe there should be very little controversy. But we certainly want to make sure we allow adequate time.
Well, and I'm raising it for that reason as well. I mean, today was a really efficient day. I mean, wealth, tax, and housing, and single cells and AMT. But I do think that one, I just wanted to tell you as the minority... we'll probably have lots of amendments, and we'll want a lot of time. So I hope you will.
A fine piece of legislation like yours, Representative Westerberg, amendments? I find that hard to believe.
We just want to make it better, Mr. Chair. I would think that, you know, with the two bills, that we'd just be concentrating, you know, on the tax provisions within those bills. So
should be able to move them out in what, 10, 15 minutes?
I'm guessing right in that vicinity.
Okay. All right. Meeting adjourned, members.